I have always felt out of my body. I haven't felt comfortable in my skin for all of my life. This idea that like when you're using, there is nothing but the present. It just is as close to feeling at home than any other place.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Katie Mack suffered from opioid addiction for 10 years.
I very specifically remember the first time I used OxyContin. I just remember being at this boy's house who I was in love with since I was 9 or something. And he was 16. I was 15. It was like the upstairs attic-y part. He was like, yo, you want some? And I said, yeah. For some reason, I wasn't getting what I needed to feel loved. And so there was no like one hug that was going to like solve this not feeling of being loved. There was no like high five or like soccer team that was going to like make me feel like I was part of a community. I had already sort of like developed whatever pathways that had made me feel othered. And then I got this whole other new roadmap. And then I could just drive down that. And it was faster and it was easier. And I'm 35 years old, so I, you know, have dated a lot of people. I had a partner for about 5 years who really put up with a lot from me. And I think he was very comfortable in his skin. And I think, you know, he really tried to make me feel loved. I just wasn't able to receive it. And I think that's why sometimes drugs or heroin for me was so, or felt so simple for a short period of time until it didn't. It's because like I knew I didn't have to have a conversation about it. I didn't have to talk about my feelings. I knew what I was getting. And that felt very simple. After having used for some amount of time, it's like an absence and it's like an itch. And then like when you use, you get that quick calm. Your brain won't stop or this other thing won't stop. And then you're able to like chill for a second. It's like being swaddled. Like you can self-soothe. And you get to like, I mean, often you get to decide how much self-soothing you need. And I, you know, since leaving my mother's womb, right? How do I give myself, you know, what I need? How do I self-soothe? How do I protect myself from feeling bad or insecure or hurt? It's a combination of like knowing that there's nothing that needs to change about you. There's a sense that like people like you. And it's all kind of these like this locking system that sort of happens in my personal body. It is accompanied by a feeling that is accompanied by a sound effect. And it is often the sound of like a lock clicking and then it's secure. And that feels good. It feels good. And it feels secure.
Katie Mack. She's an actor, writer, and podcaster based in New York. She suffered from opioid addiction from the age of 15 to 25. A little later in the show, we'll hear how she made it to 35. Well, Maya Solovitz, that feeling that that Katie described, do you know it?
Absolutely. One of the most common descriptions of the opioid high is feeling warm, safe, and loved.
And that's a feeling that you know personally.
Yes. When I was addicted to heroin, the first time I took it, I was just like, oh, I'm okay. I can stop worrying. I am not like the world's worst person that everybody hates. And self-hatred and shame are just an enormous part of addiction long before you ever actually become addicted. And so just getting relief from that horrible feeling was addictive to me.
Well, Maya is a neuroscience journalist and author of Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. And recently in the New York Times, she also published an essay titled Opioids Feel Like Love, and That's Why They're Deadly in Tough Times. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. I think, Maya, could you help us understand a little bit more about what you mean? I mean, even through your own personal experience, that it feels like love, because love can be a lot of different things. But like physically, soulfully, what did it feel like when you first got high?
It's just like being ultimately nurtured and swaddled and being safe and mommy loves you and you're all okay. It's a very primal feeling of okayness and acceptance and just being all right. I should add here that it's only about a third of people who take opioids medically or for whatever reason they may take them, but only a third of people get this kind of warm, loving feeling, probably because they're wired such that they have what they need in their endorphin system, and adding extra to that makes them uncomfortable and, in fact, makes them feel numb and distant and nauseous.
So the 70% that don't feel that sense of love, that's what you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. And so that would be what you might call neurotypical people who don't have this feeling of emptiness and disconnection and loss that can come from trauma or incipient mental illness or just general despair.
Okay. Well, so still, point taken about that it's roughly 30% of people who become addicted to opioid who have this almost
so- No, it's 30% of the population, because about 70% of the population has taken opioids medically.
Okay.
Only about a third of people who take opioids get this feeling, and only about half of those become addicted, because sometimes people get this warm, overwhelming feeling of safety, and they're like, oh my gosh, I could get in trouble with this. I don't want to lose my wife and my cat and my dog and my family. And so they're just like, I'll never take that again. But people who have that thing missing and they find this sense of safety in a drug and they don't have anything else to live for, that is where the risk is.
Got it. So 30% of the population overall who has at least – of the population overall, let's put it that way.
Okay. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, so that's still a huge percentage, right? That's one in three people in this country. And yesterday when we asked folks to call in if they've ever experienced this sense of love when they were taking or addicted to opioids, we got a lot of responses, Maya. I mean, just listen here. This is John from Detroit, who said he was prescribed opioids for back pain 8 years ago and got hooked.
The best way I can explain the feeling was I once heard somebody explain it as a nice, comfortable little wall from the outside world. You're kind of in your own head. It's euphoric. And it is. It's almost like provides a sense of love and safety to you, especially from your previous traumatic issues or anything like that.
Maya, do you want to respond to that? I mean, is this a feeling that comes after for that susceptible one in three Americans? Does it come after the first time taking a dose of opioids? I mean, John there said he started for back pain, not deliberately to get high.
Right. And I mean, I should point out that the research shows that 80% of people who become addicted to prescription opioids actually don't have a prescription for them. They're more like the story of the woman we heard earlier in the show, where they get it at a party, they get it from friends, they get it from family. It's really important to note this, because right now we're doing terrible things to pain patients who actually do need medication in the idea that if we just keep cutting the medical supply, we will save people. And that is causing tremendous harm right now. So I want to make sure to emphasize this is the feeling that people with addiction get. And it is really seductive to people when the rest of their lives feel empty.
Right. Well, the reason why we want to talk to you about this is that there's this sense this general sense that one of the things that when people become addicted to opioids, they're just constantly chasing a sense of extreme pleasure. But what you're describing here again, for this particular part of this particular section of America is actually something quite different. It's not extreme pleasure. It's nurturing. It's comfort. It's care. It's love. I mean, again, and this was very, very powerful in the response that we got. So let me just, sorry, Maya, just I was quite overwhelmed with how many people called in saying, I have felt this. So just this is Ben McKenzie, who listens to On Point from Columbus, South Carolina, and he's been in recovery since 2014. He's been able to turn his life around after experiencing homelessness, and now he's doing a master's degree in social work. And here's how he described how powerful that feeling of love was.
You know, I have a two-year-old daughter, and this is unfortunate, but it's true. Like, the second best feeling I ever had was when I heard my daughter cry for the first time when she was born. It's like this light switched on in my head, and it was, you know, there's a lot of joy and a lot of warmth. But the first best feeling was injecting heroin for the first time, and it's not even by a close margin.
Maya, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And you hear that all the time. And the important thing to know about this is, you know, when we're talking about what hooks people, it's about that being left out and feeling ostracized and hated. And when you get that sense of warmth and safety and comfort, of course you're going to go for it if you are coming from this big place of feeling an outsider or feeling horrible about yourself.
Mm. Well, we have about 30 seconds before we have to take our first break, Maya. What piece of the puzzle does this add, the sense of understanding that some people feel love when they're high on opioids, to the, you know, the sharp rise, for example, that we've seen over the past year, or even just, you know, in the past 10 or 20 years, where in places that are economically depressed, there's been such a rise of opioid addiction?
Well, we have this sense that people with addiction are nasty, horrible, selfish people who don't, you know, who just want what they want, don't care about anybody else, etc. The reality is they're seeking love. And that should get you to be more sympathetic to people with addiction, because it is not, we don't want extra, we just want to be okay. Mm. And that is really where it's at with it.
Well, Maya Solovitz is a neuroscience journalist and author of Undoing Drugs. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today, we're talking about a part of opioid addiction that for some people, when they're high on opioids, what they're feeling is not this intense pleasure, but rather a profound sense of love and caring, and why it matters to understand that, especially in an age of fraying social bonds and economic uncertainty. And I'm joined today by Maya Solovitz. She's a neuroscience journalist and author of Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. And Maya, as I said a little earlier, we got an overwhelming response from listeners who have personally experienced, as you have, this particular aspect of opioid addiction. For example, here's Matt Wolf, who listens to us from Washington State. And he said opioids made him feel superhuman, and he used for 10 years.
The reason why I was attracted to it in the first place is that it made me feel superhuman. I could do things that I couldn't do otherwise. I could talk in ways to people that I couldn't speak otherwise. It was a very powerful and enabling drug for a while. And I hope that anyone who's currently using will look at their life and see that that effect of euphoria and love and being better than you might have been otherwise is only temporary, and soon it makes you worse.
That's On Point listener Matt from Washington State. And here's listener B from Columbus, Ohio, who used opioids for about 5 years and says he's been clean now for 10.
I was never able to capture that feeling again. It kind of made me feel like everything was great and amazing with me and my life, even though it was in shambles.
Another of the many On Point listeners we heard from. Now, Maya, in a moment, we're going to talk in depth about what's actually happening in the brain of people who suffer from addiction and experience that sense of love when they're high. But can you talk a little bit more, because we ran into the break beforehand, why is it important to understand this factor of addiction in some people? Again, I said a little earlier about how it seems like we're living in an age of fraying social bonds. Many people experiencing a lot of economic uncertainty. So tell us why this is an important part of the puzzle.
Well, because when you understand that people with addiction are just seeking to be okay, they're not lazy or evil or bad for the most part. You know, there's all there's bad people amongst any group of people. But mostly, you know, we kind of just want mommy. And you have a much more sympathetic perspective when you understand that. It's also important to understand that opioids are part of our stress system, and what they do is they allow us to kind of turn off the stress system. So the opioids in your brain de-stress you. They're like, okay, the stress is over. You're now home and safe. It's all good. And it's there to make social connection soothing. Mm. And if you don't have enough social connection, then the drug becomes much, much, much more attractive.
Yeah. You know, this is so fundamental, right, to being alive. I'm just thinking about how deeply wired we are to want to feel loved. I mean, it's for survival, quite frankly. I'm thinking about,
yes,
you know, like half century ago. I don't remember exactly who the scientist was, but do you remember those films that maybe you saw of experiments with like baby rhesus monkeys, I think, and like,
yes,
they were denied being around their mother, but like once some of them were given like a towel that was wrapped around chicken wire, and they would just cling to that towel wrapped around chicken wire for their whole lives. And even those little baby monkeys did better than the ones who were completely denied any kind of contact or you know, loving touch from another creature. So I mean, it's like
It's a really, really cruel experiment, but it shows you just how much, because also those monkeys would choose to cling rather than to be fed. You know, we fundamentally, as mammals, we're interdependent. We need each other. One of the reasons I take issue with calling addiction dependence, as Nora Volkoff does, is that addiction is actually compulsive drug use that occurs in the face of negative consequences. Dependence is just needing something to function. And we all need love to function. Because if you take that away, as you can see what happens when we do all this social distancing and we have all this economic inequality, we start to turn on each other and we get extremely stressed and bad things start to happen.
Right. Well, you mentioned Nora Volkoff. She's Dr. Nora Volkoff, and Dr. Volkoff is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. And she's with us now from Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Volkoff, welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
So tell us a little bit. Help us first understand, I mean, almost on the cellular level, What is it that the opioids are doing in the brains of people who experience that loving feeling? That creates that feeling.
Well, what opioids do is basically they stimulate the opioid receptors, and in the location of the opioid receptors actually occurs throughout most of the brain, and it is higher, has higher concentrations in areas of the brain that make us have a sense of well-being, as well as areas of the brain that regulate, for example, maternal behaviors and social interactions, as well as areas of the brain that regulate pain. So it's therefore not surprising that when we have social interactions, when we touch someone, that it is that creates a sense of well-being, pleasure. And again, sometimes we use the word pleasure without describing it properly, but there is this sense of everything feels good. And that's how we feel when we are others we love. And that's mediated by endogenous opioid signaling. And just like pain is mediated by endogenous opioid signaling. And this illustrates too why when you go to the dentist or you're in suffering and someone touches you, that act of touching will liberate endogenous opioids, and that will actually make you feel better, but also will have an analgesic effect.
Uh-huh. Well, so when you talk about what's happening in the brain, say under normal circumstances, some people are familiar with hormones like oxytocin already, the quote unquote, the hormone of love, right? Is that what the opioids are mimicking? I mean, what exactly is happening?
Well, there you have a bidirectionality between oxytocin and opioids. So oxytocin makes us feel good in terms of promoting maternal behavior, like through lactation, because when you lactate, oxytocin goes up, and then that liberates endogenous opioids that activates the opioid receptors. So the way that the behaviors linked with oxytocin that promote, for example, maternal behavior towards the infant is driving signaling through the endogenous opioid system. And endogenous opioids themselves may also stimulate oxytocin release. So you have this bidirectionality.
I see. Okay, so your line's not perfectly clear here. So let me just to repeat what you said, and please tell me if I got it right or wrong, Dr. Volkoff. But that essentially there are opioid receptors in the brain, right? And that with natural opioids that the body produces on its own, they can be triggered by, let's say, the rise in a hormone like oxytocin. But then, people feel that naturally generated sense of well-being and love. But when we're talking about some people suffering from opioid addiction who feel that sense of love, it's basically those receptors are being activated by the external opioid. Is that roughly right?
Yes, that is correct. And the problem when you activate by external drugs like heroin or fentanyl is that you down-regulate your own endogenous signaling. Uh-huh. And what that means is that when you are not under the influence of the drug, you're going to be in a terrible deficit. And that is a very discomforting sensation, very, very aversive.
I see. Okay. So Maya, let me turn back to you. So we have a basic understanding here of the neurology of what's happening. How long has this link between the sensation of feeling loved and externally taken opioids been researched? Because this your essay in the New York Times was the first time I'd ever actually read about it.
Yeah, no, I'm always astonished by how people don't know this stuff, because it's really the fundamentals of the way we connect to each other come through the opioid system as mediated by oxytocin. Because interestingly, if you just take oxytocin, which is the so-called love hormone, if you just were to take it, you wouldn't feel anything, which is really weird. Like, you would expect it to cause a high or to cause – that's because it's acting through the opioid receptors.
So, but tell me more, though, because you've talked to physicians
about
in the past. Yeah, yeah,
yes. Yeah. So a man named Jaak Panksepp was one of the early researchers in this area, and he found that at doses that didn't even make the animals sleepy, you could relieve the separation anxiety and separation distress cries from young mammals by giving them these low doses of opioids. And conversely, if you block opioids, it will increase the separation distress cries. So he tries to get this published in Science, which is like the most prestigious journal, in the early 70s. And they're like, oh, no, that's too hot to handle. We can't do that. You can't compare maternal love to like heroin. Like, how could that even be? But in fact, that is how it works. And this is why heroin is so attractive to people who have been traumatized, people who don't have good relationships with other people for whatever reason, whether they're on the autism spectrum or they're just socially isolated. So it explains a lot about who is at risk for opioid addiction and who will benefit from greater socializing and will need access to that in order to recover.
Okay, I don't know if this is an appropriate question, Maya, but I got to ask. I mean, it seems so intuitive to me that maternal love is this like thing that we are compelled to seek and want to feel. I mean, not just in terms of receiving it, but giving it. Like, I will tell you, hands down, I never feel as good as when I'm hugging my children. Like, soulfully, physically, the whole deal. I don't know, in the 70s, were people, could it be because like a lot of science was just driven by men, even though men seek love too? I mean, I just don't understand why he was just brushed off in the 70s.
Well, yeah, no. Well, I think they really, you know, there was a heroin epidemic at the time. People really have extreme stigma and hatred towards people with addiction. And so to say that it comes from a place as innocent as like seeking mother love was very, very shocking. I mean, it's interesting because in songs and in literature, this connection has been very obvious for a long time. There are a zillion songs that compare love to a drug. There's also a very well-known and good book called Love and Addiction that was published in the 70s by Stanton Peale that makes this analogy. And then when you look at the biology and are like, wow, this is not just a metaphor, this is actually how it works in your brain. And so we should really understand people with addiction with more compassion, because what they are seeking is just the stuff that we all want, just to be okay.
Well, so again, we heard from a lot of listeners of this program. And they really reported that same feeling, that love and sense of bonding, even if they weren't bonding with anyone at the time. The drug created that. So, Dr. Nora Volkoff, let me turn back to you here. I mean, how much now does this help us broaden our understanding of opioid addiction or dependency? Because to Maya's point, in the 70s, if we thought about it as seeking out and satisfying a need for love, that requires then empathy, not criminality, which is how we've really considered addiction for decade after decade.
Yeah, and it has been known that one of the most important factors for preventing drug taking and for protecting you against addiction is to have strong, meaningful social connections. And it has also been understood that social isolation is one of the factors that drives people and make them vulnerable for drug taking and addiction. And in this respect, of course, criminalizing a person because of their drug use histories is probably the most deleterious thing that we can do, because we're going to make them so much more vulnerable to drug taking and to addiction that the opposite pattern, which is actually to embrace them and provide them a socially meaningful connection that will help them overcome the drive to take drugs.
Mm. Well, you know, so of course the terrible irony is that when people are in the grip of addiction, oftentimes, even though in these cases they're feeling that sense of love and bonding, in reality, they're actually quite more isolated than they've ever been before. I mean, here's On Point listener Alani Bowiger, who says she has been sober from opioids for 5.5 years.
the nature of addiction for me took me to a place where I was really isolated. And like that feeling of heaven eventually turned into a feeling of hell when I couldn't stop using and was continually going through detox, building really strong friendships and feeling like I have a place in the world and I have people that I matter to, people that support me and love me no matter what, is that is the one that I go back to the most often with the largest amount of gratitude.
Maya, let me turn back to you here for a second, because as you've reported, social bonds in this country, or social networks, not online, but actual IRL social networks in this country have dropped rather dramatically. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So there are more people than ever report being extremely lonely on a daily basis. I think it's something like 30% of young adults feel that way. There's also higher statistics regarding that. But yeah, we are in a place where economic inequality has skyrocketed, where this means that we turn against each other to fight for the crumbs that are left. And we can't connect with each other when we're this stressed because we can't relieve our own stress, and therefore we're not able to get it from other people. And so, yeah, this continuously makes artificial means of feeling okay more and more attractive. And we have lots of other measures showing that trust in government, trust in each other, trust in, you know, that the world is going to be okay has fallen dramatically. And if you can't trust, it's very difficult to love. And so it kind of becomes this negative spiral of all of these things make it worse over time.
Yeah. So, like, our fraying society is making people more vulnerable to physical addiction to drugs. I mean, your reporting has found that from 1985 to 2004, the size of the average American social network fell by a third. And a 2018 survey you point to, Maya, says that only half of the participants, half of them, felt that they had someone to turn to all or most of the time. So when we come back, we'll talk about how this should, like, reshape our thought of what effective treatment might be. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about research that shows that for some people suffering from opioid addiction, taking those opioids can feel like love. It can feel internally like bonding and care and nurturing. And we're asking what that means for those most vulnerable to addiction, and if it means that we ought to consider some new ways to think about treatment. I'm joined today by Maya Solovitz. She's a neuroscience journalist and author of Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. She wrote an essay in the New York Times recently titled Opioids Feel Like Love. That's Why They're Deadly in Tough Times. Dr. Nora Volkoff also joins us as well. Dr. Volkoff is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the NIH. And we're getting a lot of response from listeners, Maya and Dr. Volkoff. On Twitter, for example, listeners telling us, my mother was an addict from the mid-1970s until her death earlier this year. During that period, we were denied her love. All her focus was on satisfying her addiction, and her family suffered massively for her needs. So Ruprecht, who wrote that to us, I am genuinely sorry to hear that. There's some other stories we've got, though. On Point listener Miles Fuller lives in Boise, Idaho. Miles is 29 and says he's dealt with opioid addiction since he was 15.
It began with prescription pills. They were so plentiful back then. It was so easy to fall into. I started using heroin at age 18 by injection because pharmacy started getting in trouble with OxyContin. That all came off the streets, and I was heavily addicted by that point, so I resorted to heroin. At first, it did make me feel so loved and such a warm embrace, and like I truly belonged, you know, in this world. But in the end, it just caused absolute pain, misery, and suffering.
However, Miles also told us he has been in recovery and clean since January of this year. So we're rallying behind you, Miles. Well, earlier in the show, we heard a little bit from Katie Mack. And remember, she had told us she suffered from opioid addiction for 10 years, starting when she was just 15.
It's like being swaddled, like you can self-soothe. It is, and you get to like, I mean, often you get to decide how much self-soothing you need. And I, you know, since leaving my mother's womb, right? How do I give myself, you know, what I need? How do I self-soothe? How do I protect myself from feeling bad or insecure or hurt?
Well, we've got the rest of Katie's story now. She's 35 and has been sober for 10 years.
I got to the point where like I didn't want to do it anymore, and then I had to. And that is just a very different thing. You know, like that's how people are like, how can you be a food addict? It's like, I don't want to eat and I can't stop eating. You know, I think people know the sensation of like, man, I woke up hungover. I don't want to drink tonight. And then you drink. That's the yuck. That is the man. That's like, it's, it feels like it's out of your body. That's not love anymore. That's just plain itch. I had to know in my like soul that it was make a different choice or die. It was so clear for me. Just, you know, I could see how quickly this is going to go down. I think it's just like anything else. I went to AA and I didn't like it. It wasn't like fun, but I was like, I don't know. I know where it is now. And like this one person was really nice to me and like they told me to come back. So like, I guess I'll come back. And like it happened really slowly. And then how did it become a community? It's like, yo, at this point I didn't have any friends. So like these other people were like, I'll be your friend. When I finally found a community, the first thing I needed to be was willing to sort of like let a lot of my protective gear go. And for me, the first step again was a lot like my way into using. I saw all these people who are like cool, who are like were talking about stuff that like made me laugh because I was like, oh my God, me too. And I had this feeling of being like, I want what they have. And I watched other people genuinely be and feel happy. And I wanted to know what that felt like because I don't know if I'd ever felt that way in my life. You can't get sober without other people. You can't. You can't. Some of it is just, you know, you're so riddled with shame and you hate yourself so much. And then you see somebody else hating themselves so much. And for a second, you're like, oh, I think I should tell that person not to hate themselves so much. And for one second, while you're talking to that other person, you stop thinking about yourself. I think there's something about, you know, having something in common with a bunch of other people that just get it. I am so well loved by my friends and I feel so strongly that love. And I understand that feeling of a love that never runs out. Man, I just really like my life now. The most important thing about that is that my life is like pretty normal, but I just really like it. I kind of can't believe I'm about to say this, but the community of people I'm around is like God to me. It is whatever that means to people, right? It is this unconditional, never-ending blanket hammock catch to my life, to me, to who I am, no matter what I do, And it doesn't have like one face. It's just like this warm feeling that I know is always there. And I'm always there for it. What did I say about hair when I said it felt like coming home? And that's exactly, you know, the same feeling too. Like this warm, constantly coming home.
Except now she's coming home to community. Katie Mack, she's been free from heroin for 10 years now. She hosts a podcast called F Word Sober. She uses the actual word in her podcast, and it's a narrative show loosely based on her first 90 days of getting sober. Now, Dr. Volkoff, I just want to emphasize something that both of you have said a little earlier. This is not a sort of one-size-fits-all exploration, right? There are many different reasons why people become addicted to opioids. Some have a genetic predisposition, for example. So I want to emphasize that we're not saying that, you know, building a sense of community is kind of like waving a magic wand to help people dealing with opioid addiction. But you also said a little earlier that the natural opioid signaling in our brain, the one that does not come from the injection or ingestion of drugs, really relies on social interaction. They're key for that endogenous delivery of natural opioids. So with that in mind, how does it change sort of or what does it add to our understanding of approaches for treatment of addiction?
Well, what it's telling us is clearly that in order to be able to help someone abstain from taking drugs when they are addicted and achieve recovery, you need to provide the social support systems that will allow them to do so. And without them, as the caller just expressed, it's very, very difficult to do it. And unfortunately, what happens is as people become addicted, they isolate more and more. And part has to do with the stigmatization that we have towards people that take drugs and the discriminative ways in which we treat them. And being discriminated is very painful. So just as social relations can be very positive, a negative social relationship can be devastating. And so if you discriminate or mistreat someone, that can have exactly the opposite effect than a caring, loving one. Mm. So we need to understand this as we address the issue of treatment for people that are taking drugs, but also as a society, how do we deal with as in terms of policies with people that are incarcerated and then released into the streets with no support to actually help them stay in treatment and actually achieve recovery. So it highlights how extraordinarily important the human component is. And for example, one of the treatment programs that is quite disseminated is Narcotic Anonymous or Alcohol Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And while it does not work for everyone, it can be very beneficial. And one of the things that you are doing in these groups is create a sense of community, of belonging, a sense that someone cares.
Right.
And that is extraordinarily powerful for our well-being.
Right. Okay, so Maya, let me turn back to you on that. Your thoughts on that, because there is quite a bit of research on how of the limits of the efficacy of, say, an AA style treatment alone. But as Dr. Volkoff said, it does provide this exact sense of community that's missing for many people who are suffering from addiction. So your thoughts about that?
Sure. So people are widely varied.
Yeah.
And we need widely varied means of support for them. So for some people, it might be AA or NA. For some people, it might be going to the gym, going to the church, joining a choir, going to the local car club, whatever it is that makes you feel safe and connected. The other important piece is often medication. For me, I wasn't really fully able to feel socially connected until I got on antidepressants. And that made me a lot less needy and clingy and a lot happier. And that really solved a lot of the social isolation that I had felt for most of my life. For some people, that medication might be actually an opioid like methadone or buprenorphine. And the data is really clear that taking methadone or buprenorphine long term is the only treatment we have that cuts the death rate by 50% or more. Mm-hmm. So while it's definitely critical to get social support, a lot of people also are going to need medication in order to feel that social support. And this is kind of funny because it's like, right, why weren't you feeling it before? May have to do with some chemistry in you or some chemistry in you that got worsened by the addiction, but is often pre-existing. I mean, if you listen to the stories of people with addiction, we feel different and not okay from a really young age. And that is telling us something. Our wiring is off for whatever reason. And, you know, when you talk about genetics of opioid addiction, one part of the genetics is whether you get this loving feeling from the drug or not.
Yeah. Well, so your point being that for many people, they may need some kind of medical therapy as well to essentially unlock their ability to feel the positive benefits of the love that hopefully is also coming from increased social bonds and connections. It makes perfect sense. I mean, it's definitely like, you know, like these things dovetail with each other powerfully. It's not easy, though, right? I mean, let's listen to Dylan Baldwin, who listens to this show from the Metro Detroit area.
I'm a current user. I'm struggling in sobriety. About a year ago, I started using again. And it really does give you a sense of love, of well-being. I know it does for me. It's kind of like a replacement for all these emotions and all the problems you have in your life. You stop kind of loving yourself when you use that drug. It takes all that away, and it feels like you have something that's not going to betray you and that you can hold on to. And it's, you know, in the moment, it's solving all your problems. And the reality is it's just making all your problems worse. And I call that the downward spiral. So it's making it worse, and then that makes you want to use it more, and it's just continual.
And we also have the pandemic now, which has further frayed social bonds. It's further isolated people. So Dr. Volkoff, I mean, what's missing in sort of current common practice or policies for treatment efforts that if we put it in place, could help stop the downward spiral that Dylan's experiencing and perhaps so many others?
Well, I start by saying that one of the things that is missing is that a comprehensive approaches, because as Baya said, it is medications for opioid use disorders are life savings. They're actually beneficial at multiple levels. But many places do not accept people to go into their treatments if they are on medication, whether it's methadone or buprenorphine. And so they polarize. The field is very polarized. Either you take a medication or you go to group therapies or other behavioral interventions. And we need to get that rid of these exclusionary practices. We need to embrace this and that. Addiction is a very serious disease with a high rate of mortality, and it's devastating. People that are addicted suffer enormously. They are not doing this out of pleasure. And so to the extent that we treat aggressively other things like cancer, diabetes, hypertension, we should be doing the same thing with addiction, demanding that we provide multiple interventions and quality of care, and support systems that will allow the person to remain in treatment, which is also one of the big challenges that we have with opioid addiction. The relapse rate is quite high.
Yeah. So, Maya, we've just got about a minute or so left here. There's what we can do at the individual level or the group level. There's the different pieces of the puzzle coming together here. But also, I mean, I think we ought to take a look at ourselves as a nation, right? I mean, you've written that there are studies that say that in individual counties, for example, at the county level, those with more civic organizations and nonprofits tend to have fewer overdose deaths. Now, we're not saying that's causation, but it's correlated. I mean, is there anything that we ought to be doing as an entire nation here to be more connected?
Yeah, we absolutely need to do that. And I was so glad to hear Dr. Volkov say that we need to decriminalize, because we're wasting millions, hundreds of millions of dollars locking the same people up over and over and over again for a disease that's defined by its resistance to negative consequences. So we need to show love to people with addiction and care if we are going to make this better and really care about everybody more in the society.
Well, Maya Solovitz, neuroscience journalist and author of Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction, thank you so much for joining us today, Maya.
Thank you.
And Dr. Nora Volkoff, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Volkoff, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.